This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com.
Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. And this is the trial of the week, where I review a landmark article in critical care and emergency medicine that was published this month. So think of it as a this month in medical history. And get excited for today's episode, published in JAMA in 2018. Our trial of the week this week is the REDUCE trial, the effect of haloperidol on survival among critically ill adults with a high risk of delirium. We're so lucky to be joined by critical care pharmacist and researcher Matt Dupre. So we set the scene by discussing guideline recommendations and the evidence behind delirium treatment and prophylaxis in the early 2000s and 2010s. Then we dive into the trial of the week itself. What did the researchers find? Challenges with delirium research. What about the agent that we chose? Trial fun facts. And why we're so lucky to have Matt join us specifically to talk about this REDUCE trial is because he highlights two of his post hoc analyses from this exact trial researching this patient population. So then where are we now, of course, includes things like what is our gold standard for delirium management, incident versus prevalent delirium, and questions that we still need answered. Plus, the episode ends with an ode to Michigan athletics from Matt. So another thing, as we get closer to Selection Sunday, right, that is Sunday, March 17th, I'm going to continue revealing a little bit more of the 2024 March Madness bracket, a little bit of a tease for you all. So, reminder, we know the bracket's going to pick the most important and influential critical care trial. 68 teams, or 68 trials, I should say, and four regions. So what are those regions, you may be asking? Well, let's go through them. So we have sepsis and fluids, cardiac and pulm, neuro and patis, and bleeding and blood glucose. Four regions hitting some of our biggest disease states and important organ systems in the ICU. Now, a bracketologist is going to review and predict what happens in each region, but the winner is ultimately decided by you, the listeners. So voting will take place on Twitter, X, or Instagram. So at Pharmacy to Dose, join along, have fun. This is going to be an absolute blast. But for now, a great March trial of the week begins right now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we are very lucky to be joined by Matt Dupre. Now, Matt is an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky College of Pharmacy. And also, I'm adding this to his bio, by the way, a delirium researcher extraordinaire. You can find him on Twitter or X at PharmDupre. Matt, welcome. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing great, Nick. Thanks for having me on the show.
The pleasure is literally all on this side, and we got to get right into it because we have so much to talk about while we have someone as talented in this field as you are. So let's set the scene here, and to kind of help us, so the REDUCE trial began recruiting patients in July of 2013. So at that time, right, a little over 10 years ago, what was the role of antipsychotics in the treatment of delirium?
Yeah, it's actually really funny the timing of this trial because it gives me a really good time point to look back at. So 2013 was one of the iterations of the guidelines, right? Two iterations ago, but we have a really good time point of what exactly was going on. I hadn't graduated pharmacy school yet, but 2013, the PAD guidelines came out in January. So we had a little bit of knowledge, not as much knowledge as we have now. But basically, at the time, we were looking at benzodiazepines might be a risk factor, dexmedetomidine might be helpful, but there's really no compelling data for pharmacologic prevention. And reading right from the guidelines, their line was, we do not suggest that either haloperidol or atypical antipsychotics be administered to prevent delirium in adult ICU patients. And that was literally just from a lack of published evidence at the time.
I remember that was actually kind of a controversial statement. That was, or at least maybe took people by surprise coming that clear in saying it when most of the time they kind of skirt around it. But with the language they used, I remember at the time it was a little surprising.
Yeah, it was extremely surprising, especially because of some of the studies that had just come out, that they were very clear that we don't have the data to make a statement on this.
So then, in your opinion, as we look from kind of that iteration of those guidelines to this study, what were some of the most impactful research studies looking at antipsychotics in delirium?
Yeah, so as we were talking about with the guidelines, there were actually three studies that had come out. Two that had come out prior to the guidelines, and then one that was being published as the guidelines were coming out. So John Devlin's quetiapine study came out in Critical Care Medicine in February 2010. 36 patients, 18 got quetiapine, showed no difference in mortality or ICU length of stay, but a shorter time to resolution of delirium by about 12 hours, with people more likely to go home or to rehab and fewer days of as needed haloperidol. Despite a little bit more somnolence. So that was really our biggest piece of evidence, but 18 patients getting drug, not a ton to go on. And Tim Girard had published the MIND pilot in 2010, also in critical care medicine, with 101 patients randomized between haloperidol, ziprasidone, or placebo, with no difference in days alive without delirium or coma, similar side effect profiles. But that was a pilot, really trying to figure out, can we do this study? And then right after the guidelines came out, right after they started enrolling, Valerie Page published the HOPE ICU study in The Lancet in September. 141 patients, 71 getting haloperidol, showed same number of days alive without delirium or coma, with a little bit more oversedation in the haloperidol group. So that's kind of where we're at. We've got three big studies in ICU delirium, and not a ton of positive data.
And a key thing with all that, like all this background discussion has been focused on treatment, right? We're talking about antipsychotic treatment of delirium. So had pharmacologic prevention of delirium like really been studied at all up to this point?
Not in the ICU. So we had one really small observational study of a nocturnal regimen to maintain sleep-wake cycles that gets mentioned in the guidelines, but not really anything to change our practice. And then there were two other pharmacologic prevention studies mentioned. There was a surgical, non-critically ill patient population looking at haloperidol that the guidelines pushed off because they said the population wasn't similar enough to what we would see in the ICU. And then there was another surgical study of sublingual risperidone that showed maybe some benefit. But again, we're talking postoperative delirium, non-critically ill patients. So not really anything that we had seen in the ICU at that point.
And not necessarily data too that we can safely extrapolate, right? Completely different patients,
That's
non-critically
exactly.
ill. That was the biggest thing, right? And so
Yep.
obviously that leads us to the reason we are here today, right? Let's highlight our trial of the week, the effect of haloperidol on survival among critically ill adults with a high risk of delirium, the REDUCE RCT published in 2018 in JAMA. So, reminder, I'll go through kind of highlight some of the methodology and background. And then Matt will come on, talk about any methods, re-emphasize, highlight things I missed, et cetera, and then talk about the results from this trial. So,
an international three-group randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, multi-center, investigational-driven study. Taking place 21 hospitals in the Netherlands. I like that they included both teaching and non-teaching hospitals and enrolled patients from July 2013 through December 2016. Taking place at 21 hospitals in the Netherlands, both teaching and non-teaching hospitals, which I like that they highlighted, enrolling patients from July 2013 through December 2016. Now, adult ICU patients who were delirium-free with an estimated ICU stay of 2 days or more from the attending physician were eligible. Now, a couple key exclusion criteria, right? Neurologic diseases such as dementia, Parkinson's disease, maybe an acute neurologic condition, antipsychotic use prior to admission, or QTC greater than 500 milliseconds. So it's kind of a summary, but in short, diseases or conditions that would affect the efficacy or safety of this treatment. So kind of keep that in mind. The researchers immediately worked to get informed consent, but if not possible, the deferred consent procedure was utilized. And eligible patients were randomized to one of three arms, right? The placebo, 1 milligram haloperidol, or 2 milligrams of haloperidol. The study treatment was administered IV 3 times daily, and it continued through ICU discharge or until the occurrence of delirium. And in cases of, right, the severe agitation or delirium, study medication was stopped, and open-label haloperidol up to 5 milligrams was used. So the primary endpoint was 28-day survival. So important, remember, 28-day survival, not mortality, when you think about the data. And an important point is that all patients receive non-pharmacologic delirium interventions as part of their daily ICU care. So Matt, come back, highlight anything I may have missed, and then come through with some of the what the results of the reduced trial.
Yeah, so one important thing to keep in mind is there was actually a dose reduction protocol for some of the vulnerable patients in the study. So some of the older patients or patients that might not be able to tolerate the full dose got half dose. So in the 1 milligram haloperidol group, that would be a 0.5 milligram at each administration. And for the 2 milligram, they move into the 1 milligram. They're still analyzed in the 1 milligram, 2 milligram, and placebo groups. Something that all of our listeners should know, the haloperidol 1 milligram group is stopped early. So if you go look at the numbers, they look really weird. Haloperidol 2 milligram, there were 732 patients, 707 patients in the placebo group, and 350 in the 1 milligram group. The fourth interim analysis was done when 1,000 patients were enrolled. They found futility of the haloperidol 1 milligram group, so they stopped enrollment into that group. The investigators didn't know which arm was stopped. They just knew that it was now a two-arm trial. So all of the comparisons you're going to hear me talk about are comparisons strictly between the 2 milligram and the placebo group. And there's not a ton interesting. You're going to hear me go through this, and it's the same thing over and over. But there was 0 days of difference in days survived in the first 28, with a median of 28 days survived in both groups. That translates to a 28-day survival of 83.3% for the 2 milligram group, and 82.7% for placebo. When we talk about secondary outcomes, they went out to 90 days. Zero difference in days survived within the first 3 months, with a median of 90 days in both groups. Delirium incidence between the two groups we're discussing, 33.3% in haloperidol, 33.0% in placebo. No difference in days to delirium, median days of open-label treatment, which was 2 days for both groups, dose of open-label haloperidol, which was a medium of 3 milligrams per dose. And then we had a similar duration of mechanical ventilation, similar incidence of unplanned extubation, similar rates of ICU readmission, similar length of stay in both the ICU and the hospital at large. And then in the entire study, so 1,789 patients, we had 5 serious adverse drug events. 3 of the patients with adverse drug events died, but they were split evenly between the three groups. So there were 2 adverse drug events in the 2 milligram group, 2 in the 1 milligram group, and 1 in the placebo group. And that was not statistically significant between the three.
So the first thing that kind of stands out to me with this study is, you know, was haloperidol, do you think, chosen for any specific reason? Do you think we would have maybe seen any difference if we chose what we'd consider like an atypical antipsychotic rather than haloperidol, like a quote-unquote typical antipsychotic?
Yeah, so haloperidol was the workhorse. I think we're all fairly familiar if we spent time in the ICU. Haloperidol has kind of been the mainstay drug for the last half century. Pretty much as long as it's been out, it's been the go-to for patients with behavioral issues. And our ED colleagues would say the same, right? We hear about the B52s being dropped on patients with agitation. Haloperidol has been utilized very frequently throughout psychiatric care and ICU care. So we're familiar with it. We know the safety and side effect profiles that we're using. So it was a very easy drug for us to turn to and say, well, we've used it for management of delirium, for treatment of delirium in the past. What if we give it to prevent delirium? What would we see there? And when we think about differences between typical or first generation antipsychotics and second generation antipsychotics, the only thing any of those have in common is their ability to interfere with the dopamine 2 receptor. So antipsychotics, dopamine 2. We have a little bit of data on using atypical antipsychotics. So we talked about the MIND trial in the intro. The MIND USA study was published by Tim Gerard in, I think it was 2019, looking at acute respiratory failure and shock. That showed no difference by using ziprasidone. But I think all of our listeners are aware that we use second generation as kind of a term of convenience to talk about the atypical antipsychotics. But we should in no way think of those as equivalent drugs. So ziprasidone, risperidone, olanzapine, all of our atypical antipsychotics just don't work the same way as haloperidol, but they all have their own receptor profiles. So we've looked at ziprasidone. We obviously have a little bit of data on quetiapine in the prophylaxis setting, 18 patients worth, plus all of our anecdotal evidence. But we know that each of those has a different receptor profile for serotonin, for other dopamine receptors, for our histamine receptors, our muscarinic receptors. So we could potentially see a different result if we were to use one of those different drugs, but there hasn't been a lot of groundswell behind using anything else because we haven't really seen a lot of effect with anything else.
What a great explanation from somebody who obviously is involved with research. So you're going to understand these drugs probably a little more than us just at the clinical level and kind of discussing the differences. You know, it makes complete sense when you say it. It's one of those, once you hear it, you can't I can't unhear it, but I didn't really think about it until you said that. So what a great explanation kind of talking about the differences there. Now, you know, we've highlighted in previous episodes, anytime delirium has come up, anytime we've talked about it on literature review series and previous trials of the week, any other episodes, how hard delirium research can be. So as a from a researcher's perspective, what are some of the biggest challenges studying and researching this patient population?
Yeah, I think it's really easy for me as a delirium researcher to look at things and think everybody should be focused on delirium. Why are we not doing all of the things that we know are evidence-based? But there's been a lot of work done in the past decade on just getting non-pharmacologic measures in place. So uniform use of non-pharmacologic measures to kind of get that baseline of what is our standard of care. Delirium detection becomes a real issue for us. With prospective work, it requires a lot of education of nursing staff, education of research staff. And moving that forward. But for someone that does a lot of retrospective research now, delirium detection in claims is very specific, but very non-sensitive. And anything using retrospective data, we're reliant on what did the bedside team do in order to detect delirium. So that's a huge problem for us. And I think something you highlighted in the methods here, consent is a huge issue in any of our delirium research. Here in the US, it's especially difficult because in most places, ICU patients and in general, but patients with altered sensorium are considered to be unable to provide consent. So, for work that we've done when we've enrolled for MENS 2 or other delirium treatment studies or studies of sedation practices, we have to find legally authorized representatives, which not every patient has. They have to be local. Or able to be reached in a timely manner. One of the positives of the COVID pandemic, if you can say anything positive came out of that, has been a modernization of some of these consent practices. So we've been allowed to move to electronic consent in a lot of cases, whereas in the past we were using things like phone consent that had to be followed up with a wet signature in person within a timely manner. Now we can do those things through tools like RedCap or DocuSign in some cases. But the ability to use electronic data capture in order to obtain consents, as opposed to trying to find somebody that has access to a fax machine. Medicine, the only place in the 21st century where ability to use a fax machine is something you could continue to have on your resume in 2024.
That's so good. I also am going to have to steal that in the nomenclature for somebody signing in person, a wet signature. That's in the era of DocuSign, though, you think about it, I probably signed 50% of them electronically. So that's really, really good.
Let's not plug DocuSign too much, Nick. Apparently there's potential HIPAA issues with using it. RedCap is completely HIPAA compliant. So for all of you looking for ways to get electronic consent, RedCap is your go-to.
And RedCap and research in general. Yeah. So, you know, you highlighted one of the biggest differences, why we see so many studies in this population done internationally, the consent process. But is there anything else that we can learn from our international colleagues as it relates to either research or management strategies?
Yeah, I think some of the things with standardization of practice are really great in other countries. But in the Netherlands, they tend to have a lot of mixed ICUs. So we get a more general mixed population where you have surgical, medical patients treated in the same manner. So you have standardization of practice between patients, as opposed to the medical ICU practicing different from the neurologic ICU, practicing different from the surgical ICU. I really think, just to highlight it again, those modern consent practices, things like delayed consent, emergency consent, that are so difficult to do in the States for obvious reasons, are reasons that we tend to see those studies be done in Europe and in international countries because of their ability to use some of those other consent practices.
Okay, then I want to highlight a couple trial fun or interesting facts. I got three of them. So number one, it's discussed in the supplementary materials, not one author has a single conflict of interest. In that era, that's just impressive. So got to shout that out. All study medications were in ampules. I think that's a common research practice. I'm not going to lie, that sounds miserable. Ampules are probably my least favorite container to use, but I understand from a research perspective how much easier it is to blind an ampule and to do that. But as if you had to break it open, they're my least favorite ones to do. When we had a nicardipine shortage, oh, that was terrible. And then
just think about the number of filter needles used in order to do this study.
How many someone got stuff in their thumbs. It's just one of those, it never works out the way. Now maybe the international colleagues got something different than we do and their ampules are better. I would believe that if you told me that. And the third thing, not necessarily, I wouldn't say this one's fun. This is more interesting. Just I've never seen it. The supplementary material also details the specific financial compensation for different patient injuries for those participating in this trial. It makes sense to me that that would be a practice, but I've never seen it like specifically laid out in complete layman's terms, in all of them. So those are just interesting facts I want to bring on, right? Trial of the week. We're getting a little bit of the nitty gritty for you all, the listeners. Now, where are we now? So before we discuss where are we now, I was hoping you could break down a concept that I think is so important for understanding in delirium research. And it's what's the difference between incident and prevalent delirium?
Yeah, Nick, this is a question we get all the time, and it's a term that was new to even the delirium world, but anybody with a background in epidemiology is probably screaming at their radio or their podcast listening device right now about what the difference is. So incident delirium is just first time or new cases of delirium. So really for a study like the reduced trial, we're looking at everyone that came in was delirium free. So every case of delirium that was detected in the hospital is an incident case of delirium. Prevalence or prevalent delirium is kind of all the cases that we see. So anybody that comes through the emergency department, comes out of the general wards, or comes from home that has delirium is considered to be prevalent. They wouldn't have been eligible for this study because they had to be delirium free on admission to the ICU. But when we think about where we're going with delirium, we think about a difference between incident delirium and prevalent delirium. And really the big issue for us as researchers is with prevalent delirium, which includes patients that come into our ICUs having delirium, we don't know how long that delirium has been present. So if we think about something like stroke, we look at door to needle time as a key marker in stroke care. We're not able to determine time from admission or time from delirium onset to treatment in patients that have prevalent delirium. And that's been a key thought process in a lot of the work that we've been doing over the past 5 years is, are we seeing things like immortal time bias or time that we can't account for that may be altering our ability to determine associations with mortality or associations with treatment, right? It may be that if we get treatment to somebody with delirium within 6 hours, within 12 hours of delirium's first appearance, we may be able to improve outcomes. But in order to be able to study that, we need a definitive first time point. So our way of getting at that in some of these studies is to use incident delirium, or what we think is incident delirium. Because delirium has a fluctuating course, we cannot be 100% certain that every case of incident delirium is truly incident. But we hope that patients that are cognitively intact when they arrive in our unit give us a better understanding of what that incidence of delirium is and what our time to treatment is, and helps us to answer some of those questions.
You're highlighting how you're using, you know, the incident delirium to try to figure out that time point to try to help your kind of research study point time zero. But is there a specific type one way or another that has shown positive signs or signals with treatment, or is that something that we're really still trying to figure out?
So I have some data that came out of the reduced trial that looked at incident delirium, and it showed a different mortality pattern than we've seen with all comers. One of my secondary analyses from the trial showed that incident delirium is not associated with increased mortality at 1 month and 3 months after ICU stay. But we have lots of data before that that shows that prevalent delirium is associated, which is where we get to that talk of time to treatment or time to recognition of delirium potentially being an important model that we look at. There's a really important study for anybody interested in delirium, 2014 by Klein Klauenberg and colleagues, that came out of a different Dutch group that used marginal structural models to try to answer some of these questions. So marginal structural models are advanced PhD level statistics that attempt to control for a lot of these pre-hospital issues that we talk about. And when they did that, they didn't show an association between delirium and mortality as well. So there's a little bit of debate in the delirium world about what the outcomes of delirium are. For the longest time, it was delirium is associated with increased mortality. We have new data that shows that it doesn't, may not increase mortality, which a lot of our listeners would be like, well, then why do I care? Delirium still is associated with longer ICU stay, longer time on the vents, increased cognitive difficulties, increased likelihood of being discharged to locations other than home, increases in dependency and activities of daily living. So even if we don't have a mortality difference in patients that have delirium, there are still long-term effects for all of our patients that mean that this is still something that we need to think about.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. One of the many reasons I've been excited to talk with you about the reduced trials because your work with the research team with this data set, and you highlighted one of your post-hoc analysis,
Quick pause. What an incredible statement to be able to save one of my post hoc analyses. But you talked about one of them, but I wanted to kind of specifically highlight the critical care medicine analyses, the association between incident delirium treatment with haloperidol and mortality in critically ill adults. So what did you all ultimately find in this analysis?
Yeah, so we took 14 of the 21 ICUs that enrolled patients, which amounted to 1,495 patients with complete delirium and coma assessments. And we did some time-varying Cox regression models for both 28-day and 90-day mortality. We controlled for days spent with delirium, days spent with coma, age, APACHE 2 score at baseline, sepsis, requirement for mechanical ventilation, and ICU length of stay. And we modeled treatment haloperidol as a continuous predictor using average daily treatment dose with a time interaction. And for 28-day mortality, we found that each additional milligram of haloperidol up to 15 milligrams per day, which was the max amount of haloperidol that could be given in the trial, we found that each additional milligram decreased mortality at 28 days by 7% and at 90 days by 3%. And our time variance showed benefit for doses out to day 19. And day 20, that difference went away, but the first 19 days. And that was consistent when we controlled for treatment randomization arm. So whether or not you got haloperidol 1 milligram, 2 milligram, or placebo in randomization, that was consistent. And that's consistent with the results that the group out of Indiana has found and with the new results that we've seen out of 8ICU. So it brings up a lot of questions about, is there a mortality benefit of haloperidol independent of delirium treatment? Or is there some sort of delirium mediation that's going on where haloperidol is treating some symptoms and helping patients get better? We do have to acknowledge that there may have been some residual confounding in the research that we did. We didn't have the ability to control for everything, and we didn't really use advanced methods like propensity score matching. And there may be some selection bias coming from clinician-directed treatment. So every clinician was allowed to determine when they escalated therapy for their patients based on symptomatology. So we think that hyperactive patients may have been treated a little bit more aggressively than hypoactive patients, as we've seen in studies in the past. So that may be influencing our results. But we did find a mortality benefit with haloperidol, which is something that we weren't expecting, especially given the negative results from the original trial.
Now, I want to get at something. You know, you highlighted this, the question of mortality, and with all that can confound and influence delirium research, in your opinion, is mortality, 90-day mortality in the critical care world is just something that's like everyone is starting to ingrain. The trial has to be what the RCT looks at, but is that the best outcome to measure in these patients?
90-day mortality is definitely not the best outcome to measure in these patients. I think one of the things that we're looking at more with ICU care, especially when we're talking about drugs that are influencing our outcomes, as we improve our care for mechanically ventilated patients, right, as we've seen sepsis death rates come down and we've seen other death rates come down in the ICU, mortality is not really something, especially 3-month mortality, that we think we can change with a drug in the acute sense. We're looking at shorter term mortality as our goal for a lot of the things that we're doing moving forward. 28-day mortality, in hospital mortality, or ICU mortality as being better measures of things that we're doing. But we're also really moving toward what is a patient centered research goal. So there's been some work done by delirium researchers to create a core outcome set called the DEL course. It includes 7 different outcomes. One of those is delirium occurrence, which includes both prevalence and incidence of delirium. But we have measures of delirium severity, time to delirium resolution, health-related quality of life, which is a really important measure that we're looking at. As we increase survival in our patients, we want to move from survival to survivorship. So how are patients actually able to live their lives? Are they able to return to their baseline from before they came in or close to their baseline? Or are they now living in what they would consider to be a substandard quality of life? We have measures of emotional distress, including anxiety, depression, and acute and post-traumatic stress, cognitive measures, including memory, and then mortality is part of that core outcome set. But I think we're moving away from mortality as the be-all, end-all, and more towards some of these delirium occurrence, delirium severity. One of the gold standards we've been using in a lot of our drug trials is days alive, free from delirium, and free from coma. So it's a very weighty measure, but looking at alive and cognitively intact is what we really want for our patients. So it's not good if we're over-sedating them. It's not good if they're not able to interact with their family members. We want to try to reduce the duration of delirium and increase the days that they are able to cognitively interact and remain alive.
Yeah, quality of life is so important, right? Something that our research and things have really put a positive focus on in you know, our more recent studies. So I think most of us are familiar with the phrase, right? An ounce of prevention is a pound of cure, right? So in your opinion, is our gold standard still non-pharmacologic prevention of delirium rather than treatment, just based on what we know, obviously?
Definitely. Non-pharmacologic prevention of delirium is still the gold standard. We do not have a pharmacologic agent that we can think about. We have some ways that we can do that with sedation, but there's not really a drug that we can give you and you won't get delirium. And the bedrock of that non-pharmacologic prevention is the ICU liberation bundle or the A to F or ABCDEF bundle. That's assess, prevent, and manage pain. Or when I teach my students and my learners, that's analgesia, right? We want to make sure that we're providing effective analgesia. We're managing our patient's pain. We have the B is both spontaneous awakening trial and spontaneous breathing trial. Or I tell them that's breathing. What we want our patients to do is wake up and breathe. And I think that's really one of the key things that we're seeing with a lot of the nursing research coming out is how are we timing our spontaneous awakening trials? Are we coordinating those with the spontaneous breathing trials when patients are the most awake so they have the greatest chance of succeeding at those trials and coming off the ventilator when they are appropriate? C is our choice of analgesia and sedation. So that's minimizing exposure to benzodiazepines in patients that do not have a compelling indication. So patients that are in alcohol withdrawal, delirium tremens, patients that are in status epilepticus, please give them benzos. Otherwise, please avoid benzodiazepines at all costs. We should be using things like propofol or dexmedetomidine. We don't have a really good way of differentiating between those two as far as their association with delirium. MEN2 trial showed no difference, but dexmedetomidine, propofol titrated to light sedation levels. We have our delirium assessment, prevention, and management. And then the last two letters are probably the most important. Early mobility and exercise and family engagement. And we saw this highlighted during COVID when we weren't able to do these things. Family engagement is extremely important for our patients to be able to survive and thrive during their ICU stay and afterwards. We want to have family involved as much as possible. The ability of family members to reorient their family patient while they are in the hospital is extremely important and has not been highlighted enough in our past work. So we want family members that are going to be there and are going to be engaged in the patient's care. And then we want to try to get patients moving as much as they are physically able. And a lot of you are looking at it and saying, well, my patient's on the ventilator. I have a patient on ECMO. You can still get them up. We have lots of really good data showing that in resource-poor countries, they're putting ventilators on shopping carts to get patients walking around the unit. You can walk patients that are on ECMO as long as they are not on escalating doses of pressors, right? So as long as your pressor dose is stable, you can get patients up. And even in patients where they are unstable, right? So escalating doses of pressors, you can do things like passive range of motion, passive mobility in bed, active mobility in bed. There's some work being done on adding bikes or stationary bikes to the bed so patients can sit in bed and pedal while they're on the ventilator. And what we think is happening there is getting up and moving is good because it keeps your muscles active, but also we're getting patients to a point of exhaustion, which sounds like a bad thing in the ICU, but they sleep better. Really, what we're finding is probably going to be really important for a lot of our ICU care and moving from where we're at to better care in the future is improved focus on sleep hygiene and sleep in the ICU. And one of the ways that you can do that, when you get a really good sweat, right? I know when I work out, I tend to sleep better at night. And that's what happens with our patients, right? We're not getting them out of bed and having them deadlift and doing CrossFit or run marathons, but walking around the unit twice for a patient that has sepsis or a patient that is on the verge of delirium is probably going to be at their breaking point. They get back in bed, they sleep better at night, which likely means that they are healing in a more efficient manner.
Incredible highlight. The bundle is amazing. If any listeners, if you want to learn more, Joanna Stallings from Vanderbilt joined for a previous episode talking about the ICU Liberation Bundle. That was an incredible overview. And I also want to talk about, you know, a lot of those things you highlighted. Let's go to the reduced supplementary material, right? Early mobilization, 100% of hospitals had that. Sedation protocol with targeting a low level of sedation, 90%. SAT, SBT, 95%, right? Reducing use of benzos, 90%. So when we talk about non-pharmacologic interventions in these patients, the ICU Liberation Bundle, right? This was happening. And this was happening in this study is, you know, it was started recruiting patients in 2013. So it feels a little ahead of the curve than we were doing here, right? Because I'm not sure if we pulled all our hospitals, we would be getting numbers like this. I hope we would. But I'm just not 100% sure. Now, closing us out here, what questions still need to be answered? What do we still not know with our treatment or management of delirium?
Yeah, so we're still looking at a lot of the basic science on the pathobiology of delirium. We think we have a good understanding, but it's still evolving. And there's still a lot of basic science work that needs to be done. One of the things that's happened recently is unification of the neurology and encephalopathy literature with the delirium literature. So new definitions, new guidelines on delirium nomenclature came out in 2018 that referenced delirium as a phenotypic expression of an encephalopathic picture encephalopathic biology. So really, encephalopathy is the biologic process. Delirium is the phenotypic expression or the symptoms that you're seeing. So we know that neurologists tend to diagnose encephalopathy more. Geriatricians, psychiatrists diagnose delirium more. But if we think they're a related process, we need to get those two literatures talking to each other and those disciplines talking. And I think there's a lot of work that can be done from the encephalopathy basic science that we've learned in order to figure out new ways to tackle delirium. And then one of the other things that's happening now is phenotyping of delirium and specifically heterogeneity of drug effects. So we saw in the reduced study, the HOPE ICU study, that there was no difference in outcomes between patients. But we have seen in 8-ICU with some of the secondary analyses that we've done of the reduced study that there may be a mortality benefit from haloperidol. And one of the questions we have is there a heterogeneity of treatment effect that we're seeing? Are there certain patients that would benefit from haloperidol, certain patients that do not benefit? And how do we differentiate them and get the drugs to those that it will help and get a different treatment to the other subset of patients where haloperidol is not effective? So that's kind of the next frontier of delirium research is figuring out heterogeneity of treatment effect and start working to split those patients off in order to get them better care.
You know, it makes sense. It's been phenotypes have been highlighted for sepsis research priorities and ARDS research priorities. It makes sense that we would be going into our PADIS world looking at delirium in this population that we know has so many confounders. So that makes complete sense. Have to end with this. Probably one of the reasons that I actually got Matt to come on and join us today. So for those who don't know, Matt is a Michigan sports fan and It's been a big month for Michigan sports fans. So talk about how great it was being not only a University of Michigan, but also Detroit Lions fan in kind of that December 2023, January 2024 timeframe.
Yeah, it was a really great turn of the year for me. Michigan football on top of the world, the Detroit Lions making an unprecedented run. It was really great. Things haven't necessarily gone the way that we wanted since Nick and I had this conversation at SCCM. Since then, we've lost our head coach, and we're trying to rebuild the program. But we did set a record with the most players from one college invited to the combine, and we're hoping to set a record with the most players drafted from one team We got to beat that Georgia team that put 15 in the league a couple years ago.
Now, for those listening, because, you know, obviously I introduced you in the bio, University of Kentucky. So are you, wait, are you like a bandwagon fan? What do you have ties to Michigan?
So I grew up in southeastern Michigan. I went to pharmacy school at Wayne State, but my wife graduated from the University of Michigan College of Pharmacy. So I've been a Wolverine from the time I grew up, but I have the official connection as well.
I wish the listeners could have seen Matt's face when I said bandwagon fan. She's like, absolutely not. No, but in all seriousness, Matt, this was great. I appreciate you sharing not only your knowledge and firsthand experience on delirium research with the Reduced Trial, but just your discussion on delirium research in general. Anyone that's had a chance to listen to you speak at either conferences or whatnot, always learn something. This was no exception. Reach out to Matt if you enjoyed this at Farm Dupre. But Matt, appreciate you greatly. Thanks again.
Nick, thanks so much for having me, and go blue.
Wow. Another huge thank to Matt. That was awesome. Such a knowledgeable, intelligent speaker, especially in this field of delirium and delirium research. So very, very lucky. Reach out to him. And definitely reach out to me. Let me know what you're thinking at Pharmacy2Dose on all the socials, pharmacy2dose.com, as well as pharmacy2dose@gmail.com if you're an old school, like to send me an email message. But until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast.
The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com. The podcast provides general information only, does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials in the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient's own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. The user or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.